This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, designer flu and superhumans, the conspiracy theory trope in speculative fiction.
This week, I feel Jules is kind of your baby a little bit, isn't it?
Yes.
Conspiracy.
Well, it's not just it's conspiracy theories, it's secret labs, it's legal experimentation. There is a morbid and also not quite so morbid fascination with the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, and it is actually kind of a great trope. I think it's one of those ones where it's a great trope for a bit like a lot of the dystopian type fiction. Mm-hmm. It's a great one where you can take characters and put their backs against the wall and then see who of them, the best of their characters, rises to the fore and who of them, the worst of their characters, rises to the fore. And it's just a really interesting sort of, I suppose, little melting pot to stick the ingredients in.
It absolutely is. The interesting thing about it is that it's very popular in terms of tropes in modern literature. You get a lot of it. That probably comes a lot with the political territory. It comes with the fact that there are conspiracies. There are things that do happen. There are some conspiracies I don't really believe in at all either. But, you know, there are some which actually are founded and some which kind of have been proven. But there is something universal about conspiracy theories and this sort of trope that even stretches back into much older, because it does feed on this very human sense of paranoia and distrust and fascination with the idea that things may not be as they seem.
Yeah, it's the idea that the mundane world cannot be trusted because we are being deceived by those who are either in charge or in positions of power, and they don't have our best interests at heart, is putting it mildly.
Yeah.
And it is just really, really fascinating. I think I should add a caveat at this point in that I don't think Madeleine or I really subscribe to any of the extreme conspiracy theories. We're not flat earthers, or at least
no.
I'm certainly not.
Excuse me?
Well, I don't think you're a flat earther, but we've never talked about it. You might be, I could be answering for you and you're sat there going, what are you talking about, Jules? The earth is flat.
I've been sitting on this information for a while now. Yeah, I do believe that the earth is completely flat and that if I, having travelled most of the world, if I go too far, I will just fall off the side. Mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah. And, you know, things like chemtrails. I, again, don't really subscribe to that. Alien abductions, it's possible, but I kind of think if there's something like that that's happening, it's probably fairies.
That's exactly what I was going to say, but I'm so glad you said it first.
Because then I could be the lunatic.
Now I don't have to put any money in the F jar. It's you. You brought it up first.
So, and again, this is not something I would necessarily subscribe to. I'd like to think I'm kind of open to possibilities without being sort of like, that is how the world is. I'm absolutely subscribed to that.
Yeah, I have a theory that I live by, which is that we operate in this world according to possibility and probability. Now, everything is possible. You literally cannot disprove something. I could say there is a teapot orbiting the Earth right now. And it's possible because you can't disprove that there isn't. But in all probability, there is not a teapot orbiting the Earth. We base this probability on scientific fact, on numbers, on all of these kinds of things. And so we can say with confidence, in all probability, there is not a teapot orbiting the Earth. Similarly, I can say right now I am sitting talking to on my laptop. Okay. In all probability, that is true. I have physical evidence. I can see, I can touch my laptop. I can hear you, Jules. We will have evidence of this later to the people listening. That's further evidence that this episode was recorded and has been put forward. You know, all of these things increase the probability that that is true, but they do not deny the possibility that it isn't. However, if a new piece of evidence comes in which says Orpheus steps into the room and goes, "This is the Matrix," the probability that I'm talking to Jules lessens. But it's all based on the kind of the stimuli and the evidence that we have around us, which again, because we gain evidence through our senses and our senses can be tricked, always means that there is the possibility that nothing around us is real. And I think people kind of confused about probability and possibility, and that's how they're always trying to argue that something is real. They say, you can't prove that it isn't. But it's not about proving something isn't. It's about gaining enough evidence to, in all probability, show that it is.
Yeah, but definitely.
As you say, you've got to be open-minded to the idea that maybe, actually, these things do exist, or they are true, and we are really, our opinions are entirely based on the facts which have been given to us, facts which may be wrong or which may have been incorrectly interpreted.
Yeah, there's okay, just to blow everyone's mind, if you haven't thought of this before, reality is a very subjective experience. There is no way for me to prove that my experience of reality is the same as Madeline's or the same as any of yours. And in fact, as we know, I've got quite a wonky brain, so my experience of reality probably isn't entirely like everybody else's. There are just a few point touchstones of commonality there. But, you know, you could say that about everyone. But reality, as we subscribe to it, as in our day-to-day lives, we get up, we go to work, we need to eat, we need to exercise or read or play or whatever, that's kind of a shared lie. That's how we perceive the world.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You have to function as if reality is a finite resource with limits and parameters, because if you didn't, you'd go nuts. The human brain is not actually designed for the idea of infinity or infinite possibility. And, you know, most people feel really quite uneasy when they really wrap their minds around that sort of idea, quite understandably. Mm-hmm. But it's also worth thinking, the people who bug me, I guess, there's a couple of, well, someone once said to me, I love your books. And I was like, oh, thanks very much. Yeah, but I, you know, I don't believe in ghosts. I'm like, well, you don't have to believe in ghosts in order to read fantasy. That's the whole point of being fantasy, for one thing. And then they said, yeah, but, you know, I just have to say that I don't believe in ghosts. I'm like, right, so are you actually worried that you might believe in ghosts? But, and then they said, well, you know, it's really strange that you're not backing me up. And I said, no, it's not. I said, compared to something like the mantis shrimp, we see a very, very small percentage of the colours. You know, we see a small amount of the magnetic spectrum that we understand as light, and that is refracted in our eyes into vision. Our brain interprets it as vision. We only see a very, very small part of that. There are birds who see the entire ultraviolet spectrum and can more or less navigate using it. Then there are things that live in the sea that see the world a completely different way to us. And our senses are limited. Our senses are designed for us to exist as humans, as great apes, ultimately. Yeah. So to then say, yeah, but none of this exists outside of that, is a ridiculous thing to say. That's like having a shrimp and talking to another shrimp, and the shrimp saying, you know, I don't believe there's anything outside the water. I'm like, well, you're not designed to go outside the water unless you end up on someone's dinner plate. So how can you say that this is all there is? You don't actually know. Okay, admittedly, the shrimp was a weird metaphor, but do you see my point?
Oh my god. Sorry, it's just shrimp discourse.
it is literally that ridiculous. So I'm not saying, hey guys, this is all this crazy shit and you should definitely believe all of it. You shouldn't. You should subject everything to the same battery of questions of person who's telling me this, what do they stand to gain by it, etc., etc. How likely is it? What are the probabilities of it? Is it possible? And then you should live your life according to the parameters of the reality you've decided to accept. But don't make those parameters the only thing in existence, because that's just stupid.
I think for me, it's using the "do you believe in ghosts" is actually a really good way of examining it, because from my perspective, regardless of own personal experiences, let's put that aside. If I'm just a person, okay, looking at the ghost question, you've got to say that all around the world, throughout time in different cultures, there is a very, very similar mythos when it comes to ghosts and how they behave and how they look and the things which can be used against them. Now, and the experiences that people have. Now, am I sure that some of those are probably hoaxes? Absolutely, I'm sure that some of those are probably hoaxes. Absolutely, I'm sure that some of those things are stories that have been made up, things that have been exaggerated, or things that have perfectly reasonable explanations, even within the time frame that they've been given. That being said, the magnitude of the experiences, the similarity of the experiences, makes me, as a rational person, say something is happening. Now, that's not to say that that 100% means that there are dead people, you know, that return. I don't know that there are, but I can say something has happened. Something is causing this. As simple as somehow magnetism in the earth affecting the brain, or vibrations, or ultraviolet light, or, as I like to sometimes think, maybe it's an alternative dimension which occasionally sort of crosses with us, you know, crosses over with ours. And because we can only really see up to, you know, two dimensions, we can't imagine what would happen if we'd have a third or a fourth or a fifth. We just don't have the capacity to perceive it. So maybe we do have a third and a fourth and a fifth. We can't see it, but occasionally something happens which causes us to witness it and interpret it in the only way that we can. And maybe that's what ghosts are. I don't know. But I can reasonably say that I understand why people might believe that they do exist. Even if, and again, this is a hypothetical, even if I personally said I don't believe in ghosts because I've had no experience with them. That's not true. But if I was that person and say I don't believe in ghosts, I've had no experience with them, I also would feel that it would be very, very incorrect to say, just because I don't believe in ghosts, to then look down on someone who did, because they're interpreting that information differently.
Definitely. And it just, so basically, we're just basically starting this podcast off with the caveat that, yeah, we don't really subscribe to any big conspiracy theories between us.
No.
But on the other hand, it's utterly stupid when reality is a subjective experience to say that someone else's subjective reality is wrong.
Yes.
Because it's not the same as yours. Just because you haven't experienced something doesn't necessarily mean someone else hasn't.
Yeah. That being said, I maintain that the earth is round, and that anyone who thinks it's flat should maybe go to school.
Yeah, that's a hard one. That's a bit like believing that God put dinosaur bones and fossils there to test the faithful. That's a bit, when you've got a large body of evidence like that, yeah, there are gaps in the record, but it's mm-hmm. looking pretty conclusive in one direction.
Yeah. And the thing that gets me is that, you know, this is all based on science. Now, it's really important to recognise that science has been wrong in the past, but that's the beauty of science. It continuously is trying to improve itself and take in new pieces of information to inform its theories and ideas. So true science admits that it's wrong and is constantly moving forward. That's wonderful. But it also means that actually believing something based on the science that you have to the day is still sensible, even if it is then later disproven, because it is based on the concept that you are taking the facts and figures that you have to hand, which have hopefully been recorded in a scientific manner. And it's why we look back at science and we get to alchemy and, you know, and then we get to magic and we just keep going backwards. And it's just information which has been mounted on information. Information on information until it becomes a sound structure, which means that it actually makes sense to adhere to what that structure says, because it's something which has been built on for literal millennia. you know, ever since human beings started experimenting and questioning.
So, with that aside, we're now going to talk about conspiracy theories that are pretty wacky, actually.
Yep.
Within speculative fiction. And before I quite get onto that, I just want to talk about this idea of paranoia. The sort of paranoia centered around these sort of tropes and the sort of delicious chill that you get from them is based, a lot of it has to do with the Cold War. And I know that sounds weirdly specific, but yes, we had paranoia and things before, but I think it was after the Second World War that the dissemination of information became a much more global phenomenon. And then, of course, you then got sort of the widespread use of the internet, which is both a blessing and a curse in terms of dissemination of information, because not many people will actually then check there are three independent sources of verification for something if it's out there and they want to believe it. But all that aside, the whole idea of the Cold War, the sort of the Reds under the bed thing,
mm-hmm.
people looking out for weird scientific experiments and things like that, something which has actually been touched upon in Stranger Things recently, to everybody's delight. But I think it raises an interesting point, because it's something that's clearly filtered into our imaginations and then has been reflected in our fiction. And honestly, I really enjoy the trope, but there is a tiny thread of unease there that I can't quite unpick. And I don't know whether it's because the danger is in believing something that isn't true and actually causing something far worse, chicken licking style, or whether it's a case of these things are covering up genuine true atrocities. So the more glamorous, more fantastical ideas of conspiracy theories are actually hiding genuine abuses.
Yeah. And I sort of differ from you a little bit, Jules, in that conspiracy theory, I will consume media that has them, and I will sometimes enjoy media that has them, and within certain parameters, I can get really into it. But I don't actively seek them, and I don't actually like the trope very much. It makes me incredibly uneasy.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's designed to, and...
Yeah, but I don't actually... Is he?
No, that's perfectly okay. There are things where I'm like, that's going to give me existential angst for 3 weeks. Do I dare watch it or whatever?
Yeah, I have overthink syndrome, which I think a lot of people do, where, you know, you watch something and you're like, okay, and then you lie in bed for the next... for the next week, like, oh my god.
Yeah, 12 Monkeys kind of got me like that. Okay, let's look at some of the best known tropes of this particular ilk.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go straight in at the deep end with one of my favourites, and this is going to sound weird, but human experimentation.
Yeah, why does that not surprise me?
Now, before we get into the trope, it's worth saying that human experimentation has absolutely happened. Whether you're looking at the Kanenshin girls, the rabbit girls during World War II in the concentration camps, or whether you're looking at those poor young men in Australia who were deliberately exposed to radiation to see what would happen to them. And then there's the experimentation on the poor and also members of the black community in America.
Mm-hmm.
We're a shitty species. There's no two ways about it. And then you get involve somebody, complete nut job like Josef Mengele.
Yeah.
And you get horror stories that make everything we're going to talk about today just pale in comparison. So yes, I do have a genuine morbid fascination for this one, but I particularly like it when it's twisted a little bit and made not quite so terrible and framed within the sense of science fiction fantasy.
Yeah. Now, I very briefly start off this subject with human experimentation by touching on Marvel and Hydra within Marvel. Now, obviously, this is quite prominent because it is based on the fact that the Nazis did perform, as you've said, Jules, human experimentation. And there was also this general conspiracy with the Nazis, and then, you know, so later with the Russians, and then with the Cold War and all these kinds of things, of trying to explore magic. Now, that's a whole conspiracy, and I think we'll unpick it a little bit later, but sort of trying to explore magic or superhuman abilities. Now, obviously, that never really came to anything in the real world that we know of.
That we know of. Oh, I don't, well, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say that I'm open-minded on this. I don't know whether anything came of it, but some of the files that are gradually being released as they, you know, they come out of date with their, out of protection, as it were. There is, I don't know how it works everywhere, but for example, in America, they have files that are locked away for a certain number of years. Some of them are to be locked away for 100, 200 years. But yeah. After that, it's considered in the public interest that they are made available. A lot of people don't actually know about them. Just like you've got the online occult library, which is fascinating and slightly terrifying as well. And there are various other things. There are stories and things that have come out of Russia. There are stories that have come out of the UK, and we're a little bit sort of like, oh, but we're the British and we don't do anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously we do.
Yeah. So it's no wonder that Marvel have done similar kind of storylines with Hydra, except, of course, within Hydra, these experimentations are actually come to... And there's all sorts of experiments that Hydra do, including obviously their own version of the Super Soldiers or the Winter Soldiers, which we have with sort of Bucky Barnes. But also then, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, in the third Iron Man movie, you have the Mandarin, and he's obviously he's a front for, I think it's AIM. I think AIM are behind it, and they've created this Extremis, and they are performing experiments on soldiers who have lost limbs and who regain their limbs and regain kind of these powers, which actually ultimately will usually kill them because they can't control it. And they have a very high sort of death rate. Now, the thing I always found really interesting is that very often in these kinds of storylines, they do use soldiers, and you get the whole super soldier kind of storyline very, very often, of these people who put themselves forward to be experimented on for, you know, because they want power. And that kind of almost makes it acceptable because there has been this level of sort of consent. Storylines that really freak me out, and I think would freak anybody out, are the storylines which involve someone who is experimented on who has not given their consent to have it done.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's an awful lot of that as well. A couple of examples I've got. Did you ever watch the TV series Dark Angel? It was terrible, but in a really great way that I enjoyed. That was more about DNA manipulation, and these poor kids were kind of grown in a specific way. And it wasn't sort of like psychics and things, but they were, again, creating super soldiers, super agents through DNA manipulation. And there were some big mistakes along the way. And the whole thing ultimately didn't hold water. But I just really, really enjoyed the trope, because a bunch of them escaped from the lab when they were about 10 years old and went running off into the night, and then they ended up getting split up.
Yeah.
And it sort of goes on from there, and you're following one particular escapee called Max, who is always trying to conceal exactly what she is, the fact that she's this genetically engineered superhuman. With mixed results. She's not that great at hiding it. But it's really, really interesting. The whole premise is interesting. The way the show was done and the dialogue and that was a bit eek. And I think if I watched it again now, I'd be wincing quite a lot. but the idea is great. And then there's things like Stephen King wrote this one. It's one of his early ones, Firestarter. The premise of Firestarter is that way back in the early 70s, a bunch of college students kind of needed, you know, they got offered $100 each to take part in a study. And this study was a government-funded program whereby they administered a drug to these participants to see if they developed psychic powers off it. And everything was very hazy afterwards for the two particular students who took part, and they ended up chatting together while they were sat in the lab, and lots of strange things happened, and they can't really remember exactly what happened. It's just that afterwards the man is well aware that he has some sort of mental domination ability, and his wife has a telekinetic ability, and it's quite mild, but the two of them have a daughter together, Charlie. Charlie turns out to be, you know, that their slightly altered DNA comes together in Charlie and creates a truly terrifying psychic superhuman in the body of a six-year-old girl. Her speciality, she's a really cute kid, though. She's really bright. Genuinely tries to be good. But what tips them both over the edge is that the mother gets killed, and the father and the daughter go on the run, and the government is just pursuing them all the time because they want Charlie. Charlie's a weapon.
Yeah.
Charlie's speciality is burning shit down, big time, in the sense of looking at it and setting it on fire. And she can do a bunch of other stuff as well. I really like it. A lot of Stephen King fans are kind of like, oh, that's his mediocre book. But I really like that one.
Yeah.
Disturbing as this.
Strangely enough, you know, you mentioned that a lot of these kind of things come from the sort of the Cold War. And it does not surprise me that pretty much all of these kinds of stories which involve someone who's been genetically manipulated in order to have, or has, you know, been part of human experimentation of any kind in order to have powers, it almost always involves the military or somebody who's like, we can use you as our weapon.
Yeah, or a private body who hopes to sell it to the military. Now, I don't want to ruin The Diviners because I want Madeline to read the entire series so that we can geek out it together. But I will pick out this one thread. During the 1920s, I'm not sure how many people are aware of this, but there was a really strong push towards the eugenics movement.
Yeah.
People like to blame it entirely on the Nazis, but the thing is, it was actually around for decades before that.
Yeah.
A lot of it was to do with xenophobia and the fact that people did not want to share their country with immigrants. So there you go, tale as old as time there.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that their argument was arguing that certain races were suboptimal humans was part of the eugenics movement. Some of the eugenics movement was actually meant, probably quite well meant, in the sense of, no, let's all be healthier, let's not die of smallpox, let's not have children paralysed by polio, etc. Because this is pre-vaccination.
Yeah.
However, a lot of it was down to, no, we will make them stronger, faster, we will make them tall and blonde and gorgeous.
we have the technology.
Yeah, exactly. That was ultimately it. So that's an interesting historical thread. And Libba Bray and the Diviners has actually utilised this very real historical movement in New York. And, it was a big movement over here in the UK as well, lest anyone forget. And she's incorporated it into the, I would say, the backstory and the world building of her Diviners series. Because in the Diviners, she obviously has a group of very talented young psychics. One of them's a scientist, but the rest of them, they're all psychics. They all have different psychic powers, and they're known collectively as the Diviners. And they sort of discover a bit later on that it's not necessarily an accident. And that's all I will say on that.
Okay.
So as Madeline says, so when people are designing super soldiers and things, yes, there is usually a military push involved in the speculative fiction surrounding it. Or sometimes it's as simple as basically a racist movement dressed up as, no, we will make the human race better and disease-free, which is what the eugenics movement was.
Yeah. It's especially funny because the whole eugenics thing about sort of, you know, pure blood and, you know, pure stuff like that also led to a lot of genetic disorders because people were really limiting the gene pool.
Yeah, limiting the gene pool's not a great idea. I mean, it normally takes generations, but if you're deliberately line breeding humans with their own sort of close cousins and things, that's not great.
No.
And that's not going to work out well in the long run.
Absolutely not. Look at the Egyptian royalty.
Look at the Celtic royalty, to be honest. You know,
pretty generations. Much look at yeah, any royal line.
Even, you know, I mean, it took hundreds of years with Europe for them to get to that level of being really inbred, because at least they were various different kingdoms and they were all sort of marrying each other's daughters, etc. But
yeah.
But after a while, by the time we got to the Victorian era, it was very limited who could marry who, because a lot of kings had disappeared. So anyway, getting off track there, let's go on to my next trope, which is population control via designer plague, which is terrifying if you think about it. And the idea here is that some either government-funded or private concern has got together, got the funding, and put a bunch of scientists in an underground lab and started concocting ways. A privately funded concern has got together a bunch of scientists in an underground lab and said, design something that will help solve our population issues. This was something that was brought up in, I think it was called Utopia, a TV series from a few years back,
mm-hmm.
which was very disturbing. The idea of the Utopia project was that they created a virus that would kill off certain parts of the population. Ideally, yeah. They wanted to kill off 60% of the population. And this designer virus was very cleverly targeted. And the idea was that you needed to reduce the population by 60% in order to give the planet's resources a chance to recover and for us not to start killing each other for water, which unfortunately is a very real possibility. So when you're thinking, oh, I can't be bothered to recycle, etc., or I think I'll just leave the tap on when I'm cleaning my teeth, remember you're contributing to that future.
Thanks, Jules.
We can all do a little bit. Anyway, this is terrifying enough, this designer plague. Where I found it really, really uncomfortable is when you get things like Alias, where you have somebody designing a specific plague and then messing with it to the point where it will only target people with certain genetic markers, and in this case, certain racial genetic markers.
Oh, great.
And the thing is, you make it airborne, you release it, and everybody who is a certain percentage of the race you want saved will be fine, and everybody who falls below that optimum percentage gets wiped out. Now, we know epidemiologically that that isn't really what happens. You could release something that was 99.9% effective in killing off the human race, and yet you would still have that 0.01% that would survive.
Yeah.
Because that's simply how things happen. There are always a few people who are immune. Whether there'd be enough for a stable breeding population is another question.
Yeah.
But that's a really disturbing thing, because that's horribly plausible. That is something you could theoretically do. And we are aware that in Russia and various other places that they've taken things like smallpox and been sort of engineering it so that it's not affected by the smallpox vaccine, which, by the way, isn't something that's routinely given to people anymore, because we more or less eradicated smallpox in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's scary stuff, but there's a morbid fascination for that trope for me.
No, I don't like it.
Moving on from that particular trope, there's the idea that, and we're looking at weaponizing a lot of things here with science. We're weaponizing science. That's what most of these tropes are. But that one is a case of nobody's deliberately trying to create a plague with the idea of controlling the population. In fact, before we go on to that one, let's just talk about Serenity, the film that followed Firefly,
and
Pax. The idea of the Pax was that they had a new population on a terraformed planet, and they wanted to make them docile and cooperative and make them work hard. So they engineered the Pax, released it airborne, people inhaled it, and made them peaceful. It made them stop doing anything, including eating, drinking, breeding, working, or anything. And they literally just sat down and waited to die, which is horrific. And the ones that it affected in reverse became very, very aggressive and started, they became the Reavers. They became, you know, the ones who just have this violent imperative towards rape, murder and cannibalism.
Yeah.
Pretty much all the time. So, yeah, the population control trope is terrifying. And it isn't necessarily about killing people off. Sometimes it's about making them obey you.
It makes me think of Locke Lamora, actually, a little bit.
Yes.
Because they have something like that in Locke Lamora, which they use for animals. And I've forgotten what it's called. But it's this particular kind of substance, which if inhaled over time, basically sort of is a chemical lobotomy, almost. And it just makes, they use it for animals and things like that. They use it for horses, for instance, and it just makes the horse completely obedient. The horse will eat, you know, if food is literally put in front of it. The horse will drink if you know, they're given water. But the horse, and the horse will obey simple commands. But, you know, if a snake jumps, will not react. If the horse is hit, the horse will not react. It will not actually participate in anything.
Yeah, it's something that removes the creature's autonomy, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. To the extent that there is a really nasty bit in sort of book two where they mention that there were a group of boys who kind of wanted to sort of, basically wanted to mutilate some animals. So they gave these animals this this chemical so that the animals wouldn't fight back or anything. They would just sort of accept what was happening to them. Which is horrifying. And it really, really disturbed me when I read it, to the point that even though they have this kind of thing within the world of Locke Lamora, basically they used to use it as a kind of like a capital punishment. Yeah. But they even decided actually killing them and then doing this to them because you were in essence completely destroying their soul. And people were really freaked out about it. And even now, thinking about it just makes me go, oh, it's really terrifying.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like a total lobotomy.
It is.
Without the chance of the recovery afterwards.
Yeah.
Moving on to the idea that instead of these scientists in their underground bunker designing drugs or viruses or whatever that are going to control a population, they're just doing it to see if they can. Which in some ways is almost worse. And then, oops, gosh darn it, somebody spilt the beaker and all that lovely plague got released into the atmosphere and about six pages later, 90% of the world is dead. And the weird thing is, and I find this incredibly plausible, the small cogs of government and rulership are still trying to cover up what happened. They're still trying to claim that it wasn't anybody's fault, that this was a naturally occurring plague. And, you know, even the Black Death, which is one of the worst biological disasters to have ever hit the human race, only wiped out half of Europe's population. I know I say only half, but if you consider the sort of things that turn up in The Stand, the super flu, which has a 99.7% communicability rating, and there's no biological reason why it doesn't kill off everybody almost. It literally wipes out 99% of the world's population.
Oh, sorry.
which again is terrifying. This is, you know, there's many a slip betwixt cup and lip, and somebody's just dropped a beaker. And things happen. I've been in lab situations enough to know things happen. Sometimes chemicals get spilt, sometimes beakers get dropped. Would you really want to be carrying around a beaker full of highly, highly concentrated virus? And whoops, the beaker's broken. It's kind of like, why do you make beakers out of glass at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But also, it's just, really, guys, get a better ventilation system.
Well, that's absolutely what you don't want, because if it goes airborne...
No, but that's what I mean. It's like, just completely internal. Everything gets closed down. God, oh, it terrifies me. But also, can we create it, though? And also the thing that always gets me is, can we create it? And they always try to create it before they even consider thinking about, but can we destroy it?
Yeah, it's the whole Jurassic Park thing of, we got so enchanted by the idea of being able to do something that we stopped asking ourselves whether we should do it.
Yeah.
And that, there you go, that's kind of weaponized science that's become the enemy. That's the case of, we're children playing with things we don't really understand. We're playing in the traffic, and then we're surprised when the big truck comes along and squashes us. Yeah.
The worst thing is that it's not even that we're playing with things that we don't understand. It's that we're playing with things that we should understand, and yet that we think we are the masters of. So I think the traffic analogy is great, because if you run out and play in traffic, then you are playing in traffic. You know, you understand what cars are. You understand the risk that a car could hit you. But you have this arrogance about you that says, but it won't hit me because I'm me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and absolutely. Then it hits you.
and then there are some which are genuine accidents. I've mentioned the stand, and I've mentioned the stand a lot, so I won't go into it too much. But there's also Feed by Mira Grant. Mira Grant is Shannon Maguire's alter ego when she's writing dark science fiction thrillers. And Feed is a great example. What happened in Feed was that somebody developed the cure for the cold, and somebody developed a cure for cancer, unbeknownst to each other. And then a bunch of journalists, this is where the whole sort of not fact-checking and not and believing what you hear on the news without going back and realizing it's sensationalized and trying to find out what's going on. A bunch of well-meaning but ultimately ignorant journalists who didn't do their work properly publicized the results that, yes, there was a cure for cancer now, but nobody was going to get it unless they could pay through the nose. So poor people were still going to die of cancer, and nobody really cared. That wasn't the case at all. This was a private individual, a billionaire philanthropist who had every intention of everybody getting the cure for cancer if they needed it. But what it did was it made an extreme splinter cell group of activists break into the labs, and they didn't know what they were releasing. So they took the cancer cure and they took the cold cure at the same time. And they sort of managed to hijack a plane, and they released it basically into the jet stream. So it travelled worldwide. The two different cures that were basically virus-based, they combined together. And what they ended up doing was, yes, they cured cancer and they cured the common cold. Nobody gets either of those things anymore. But the two things that combined together, the Kellis Amberley virus, as it came to be known, caused ambulatory death syndrome. So if somebody died, they then came back to life again, but in the sort of the Walking Dead sense. They created a zombie plague.
It's always the chemical zombie plague, isn't it?
But I have to say, you've got to really admire Mira Grant's research in that one, because she clearly understands epidemiology. Apparently she spoke to the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta about a lot of it. She kept ringing them up and bugging them. And they were like, no, that wouldn't work. And then the last one, she said, what if you did this, this, and this? And they were like, yeah, you should not do that. And she's like, great, that's the one I'm using in my book.
I'll tell everybody about it.
So again, it can be accidental. It might not be deliberate. It might not even be a case of, yes, we're trying to make a weapon. Maybe we're trying to make a cure. And then ill-informed people who believe they understand science and believe that they're entitled to things before they fully understand them, again, cause the death of most of the population.
Yeah.
Through ill-advised actions. And that's kind of the mentality that you get behind anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, absolutely. The anti-vax conspiracy theory always really interests me, though, because it's like vaccines give people autism. And I come from a position of, okay, first of all, there's literally no evidence of that at all, and pretty much anything that has been put forward has been completely disproven, and the doctor who first came up with the theory has basically just been, you know, thrown out in shit. But even if it was true, and this is the bit that gets me, even if it was true, and vaccines did very, very occasionally cause autism, you know what? That's really not an issue, because autism, weirdly enough, is better than death.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's that huge breadth of ignorance about what autism spectrum disorder actually is.
Yeah.
And people seem to assume that you would... anyway, without going down, we could really go down a rabbit hole there.
We can get quite rabid
about anti-vaxxers.
I completely agree. And I just, to be honest, the anti-vax thing, it always really makes me laugh because I'm like, so they're autistic. That what the hell difference does it make? It, like, literally none at all. And it's this complete misunderstanding, of everything, of what it means.
Yeah, one of the stupidest... I accidentally stumbled onto an anti-vax thread on Facebook. One of the stupidest... I managed not to comment. Again, I want pause for restraint here. One of the stupidest posts I saw on there, which I imagine was made with, in a spirit of genuine veracity, they really thought this, was that vaccines stop you contacting your past selves from previous lives.
Why?
Well, they didn't have a scientific reason for it, strangely enough. But just case of, no, you should definitely not do that. My guru says that this is the case, and I believe him. I'm just like, oh my god, the bullshit people will swallow.
The thing that always gets me is that I think there's a lot of these anti-vax things come from America, and they're like, oh, the government are trying to do what? But, you know, they're also like, oh, it's all about, you know, the expense for these, that they want us to make to pay money so that they can poison us and stuff like that. Which, to be honest, first of all, is kind of sort of laughable. But, you know, okay, if we're going to go with evil governments or evil, you know, companies, then fine. Let's go ahead and believe it. It no longer makes sense if you literally go to any other country in the world which has universal healthcare.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It makes no sense whatsoever. Anyway, we've got off track a bit.
Sorry.
It's my own fault because I said anti-vax mentality and it was kind of like, oh, and, no.
We both went,
evasive manoeuvres. Which brings us on to space and the idea that aliens are amongst us, which is another great conspiracy theory.
Yeah. Well, you said it already, so I don't mind. I don't think it's aliens. I think there are fairies among us watching.
Yeah. In folklore, in terms of folklore, and if you compare a folkloric account of fairy abduction with a more modern account of alien abduction, the similarities are extremely compelling, put it that way.
Yeah,
I wouldn't like to say one way or another, but the idea that, you know, the whole the Roswell crash and the alien autopsy, etc., and things like the supposed leaked footage, which has largely been disproved. One thing I will say is that lots of people will have said over the years that they've seen UFOs. And I would clarify that a UFO is merely an unidentified flying object. So it's something that you saw and you couldn't fit it into the framework of, is it a plane? Is it a blimp? Is it a balloon of some kind? You know, is it a bird or whatever? But it's I myself have seen in the night sky something a couple of times, things which I couldn't identify. And that I later looked at, and other people have said, yeah, we've seen those things too. So whether that's a case of there is some government out there testing different types of plane or what have you, and therefore when we see things like that, they just don't fit into a framework of things we already know. That's possible. That's not the same as saying, yeah, this alien spaceship came to Earth.
I do believe that somewhere in the endless reaches of space, the eternity of space, that there is that there must be life. The thing is that how do we define what life is? You know, everything we know about life is based on our experiences on this planet. So I think it would be very silly not to say that there is an intelligence or some form of consciousness or life out in the absolute reaches of space. There must be, in some form or another, even if it doesn't resemble anything like our own.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that they have most likely found evidence of bacteria on Mars.
Yeah. So, yeah, I do believe in aliens. Do I believe in alien abductions? No, they're fairies. absolutely 100%. No, alien abductions could be real. Do I believe that our world is actually run by aliens or lizard people? No, not really. The probability on that is not very high on my probability meter.
No, I've got to say I'm with you there. As much fun as Men in Black is, ultimately, it's not very likely. It's just a great piece of fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
This is one where I kind of like, the Roswell crash and things. I find the whole conspiracy theory the reward and end in and of itself, in the sense of I'm enjoying that because I'm enjoying looking at it as a conspiracy theory rather than being part of the conspiracy theory and engaging with it. Does that make sense?
No, it makes complete sense, yeah.
It's kind of like, I like the idea that there are people who genuinely think this happened more than I like the idea of it actually having happened. Which, I don't know, probably makes me a bit of a sociopath, but...
No, not at all.
I just find it really interesting, just in the same way that the whole anti-vax thing is really interesting from a certain point of view, as well as being incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, from the outside.
Yes, from the outside. From the outside, it's fun. Okay, our final big trope to discuss is altered perception of reality. The world as it is presented to us, the shared lie that is reality that we all agree is the truth because we have to function somehow, is actually just a facade for something far, far darker.
Yeah. Now, weirdly enough, before we kind of get into this and talk about the Matrix and things, I want to mention a philosopher named Berkeley. Now, Berkeley lived many, many years ago. He was a religious man. And when I was studying philosophy, we did look at the theories of reality and how we perceive reality. And there were these theories that either you were there, you saw reality, the things that you saw in front of you touched you, they were real, and that was that. And then people start to say, but what about illusions? How does that work? And so then there's this theory that actually you see reality through some sort of lens, this information lens, which means that information can, become corrupted, which is how how illusions work. And then people said, but what about hallucinations? And so they were put to the side. And Berkeley came up with a theory, which I absolutely love. And the reason I love this theory is that it's the only philosophical theory I've ever seen which is just complete. And when I mean it's complete, it's that you can either say yes or no. You can either take it or leave it. But you can't actually punch holes in it, because within its own universe, within its own rules, it's complete. And that's beautiful in philosophy, because usually you can question pretty much anything and there's always an... But Berkeley's theory just it's nice and rounded, and so it satisfies me. Now, Berkeley's theory was that we all existed as ideas. Everything, all of reality exists as ideas in the mind of God. Okay?
Yeah.
So God is basically, we all just exist in his mind. And maybe the reason I like this is that it basically implies God is a writer. So that means that all of my characters actually exist in my own mind. That is their reality. Everything that I think about exists for them. But the reason I particularly like this is that it ties in with the idea that humans were created in God's image, which means that all of reality, the me sat here on my chair is real, my phone is real, my laptop is real, I am real, because we are all ideas of God. But because I'm designed like God, I have my own mind, which means that things can exist within my own mind, but they are not part of the shared reality. So if I have hallucinations, if I have dreams, if I imagine things, these are all exists as a reality for me, but not for others. And I like that. I really like that idea. It's just sweet. God is a writer, just putting it out there.
No, I think that's a fair point. The idea that going back to the idea that what we see is not what's really what's there, that's one that has kind of haunted me a bit since I was a child. I don't know quite why it struck me, but as quite a young child, I kept having the idea that what I was seeing wasn't really what was happening. It wasn't what was going on.
Yeah.
What it, you know, because what if everybody really looked like a lizard person, but I wasn't seeing them like that? It's one that stayed with me. So when I did actually eventually see The Matrix when it came out when I was at university, I was like massively impressed with the film, but also kind of, oh my God, you know, this is fed into this really deep-seated sort of anxiety about the world.
Yeah. It's similar with The Truman Show.
I think I only saw half of that. It didn't really hold my interest in the same way, but is that paranoid idea of, you know, what if I'm being used for entertainment?
Yeah, this idea that actually everything around you is a lie and that everyone else is in on it, or that there are other people who are in on it and you are the one being deceived. Yeah, when I first saw The Matrix, it had a pretty profound effect on me. And it actually got me really questioning what I'd actually want from life. Just put in that position, how would I, you know, how would I proceed? And the thing is that I ultimately kind of felt like maybe I just want to stay in the human world, even if it is an illusion, because actually life is sort of an illusion. And every time you stand and you look up at the sky and you look up at the stars and you realize the magnitude and, you know, how huge the is, you suddenly look at these kind of little problems that we've created based on our own little rules.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, wow, that's just sort of silly. It is an illusion, but it's an illusion that we use to sort of function. And it's an illusion sometimes which has caused mass destruction and all sorts of other problems, which we probably need to address as well. But putting all that aside, first time I saw The Matrix, I did kind of wonder, what is freedom? And actually, is freedom an illusion? And do I actually want to be free if it just means to suffer continuously?
Yeah, which is a really interesting point. This is something that Alan's been engaging with a lot on podcasts recently, in the sense of he listens to podcasts and they discuss it. Mm-hmm. And it's the fact that mathematically there's no such thing as free will.
No.
And if you just look at, if you just run the numbers, then ultimately the laws of probability will dictate how someone is going to behave.
Yeah.
Now, every so often Alan says, so do you believe in free will? And I'm like, it doesn't matter whether I believe in it or not. I think in order for us to function as a species, we need to act as though it is a concrete fact. Because once you run just on numbers, then you remove things like accountability and justice and emotional science and emotional biology, emotional reasoning from the equation.
Yeah.
Which more or less seemed to satisfy him. But the whole idea that, you know, free will is just an illusion and that we are all slaves to the numbers is disturbing, definitely.
Yeah, and weirdly enough, again, this is something that I studied, and it's this theory called determinism, the idea that actually everything is kind of cause and effect. As you say, it's the numbers. This causes this, which causes this, which causes this, which means that we literally, everything that happens to us is predetermined to an extent, because we are just a continuous line of cause and effect of which we actually have no control. But then I'm actually something called a soft determinist, and that's that I believe that free will is something different. And the way that I explain it is like this. Free will. If you believe that you have free will, does that mean that you decide when you are hungry? And the answer is no. We don't say, I have decided now to be hungry. Now my hunger is activated. What happens is that we go, I'm hungry. What do I want to eat? Okay. And inside what's happening is that different chemicals will be firing because of X, Y, and Z that will say, you want chocolate because chocolate is wonderful. Okay. And then you go, I will eat chocolate. And that feels like free will. You have you've made the decision that you want to eat chocolate, but it's all based on this idea. But you are not in control of that. Now, before we came up with these ideas of free will and determinism and all that kind of stuff, were human beings able to do that? No. No point in, at any point have people been able to decide when they want to be hungry, or have been able to decide, I have decided that now is the time that I will need to urinate. You can decide, oh, I need to go to the bathroom, so I will. But we don't have kind of, we don't decide what happens in basic functions within our body. We don't decide these things, we just act on them. So if we have never been able to do that, then when we came up with the concept of freedom in those existing parameters, freedom has come from this idea of not being able to act on the impulses that are kind of in your body. So I say, I am hungry, but someone has put me in a cage and I cannot now go and eat. I have lost my freedom. I have lost the ability to move forward. That's what freedom is actually based on. It is based on a physical kind of restraint of some description, one or another. But it goes beyond that internal sort of freedom, which has never existed. And because it's never existed, why would we therefore assume that's what freedom is? So when people get icky about, oh, I don't actually have any freedom. Yes, you do, because freedom is a human concept which is based on the pillars that we already exist in. The reason you get funny about it is because what freedom actually means is the ability to on your own choice. It's not the ability to control everything around you. So that's for you guys. If any of you understood any of that, I have literally had debates with my father about this that have lasted 4 hours and he doesn't get it, so I hope you guys do.
No, I followed it.
So we do have free will, because free will is a human concept.
I suppose where people would start picking holes in that is the idea that, you know, that the hunger metaphor, then you are being a slave then to your biological imperatives, etc. Yep. And it wouldn't be hard to then draw lines from there. But yeah, no, I agree in general that, you know, you don't, we're not the Bene Gesserit. We don't have control over every cells in our body. Or, you know, if you are, then please get in touch because I would like to learn. Yeah, so just to wrap up, we're just going to talk about, oh, well, I've said some of our favourite tropes, but Madeline kind of scuppered that a bit at the beginning by saying she doesn't like this trope at all. Our favourite examples of the sort of tropes in that we've discussed today, the conspiracy theory type trope.
Yeah. Well, because it does really, really freak me out and I don't like to touch it. I do like the kind of the more positive versions of this, whereby you have a conspiracy which is a group of people who are working in the shadows for the embetterment of everybody else. And sometimes they have their problems and sometimes they, you know, they don't shoot right, but they are ultimately functioning in order to protect everybody. So you get lots of examples of that. To some degree, it kind of exists in the Harry Potter universe.
Yeah.
Where there's this giant conspiracy with muggles, because you have a whole ministry who are basically just keeping themselves hidden. You also get it in a lot of sort of superhero stuff as well, these secret leagues or these superheroes who are acting for the best interest of everybody, but nobody can know what they're kind of up to. The Justice League do it to a certain degree. I mean, the whole Batman, for instance, you know, in Gotham, original Batman, no one really knows if he actually exists or not. Only, you know, the criminals he goes up against really know. Otherwise, he's a bit of an urban myth. S.H.I.E.L.D. to a certain degree were kind of acting underground. Kind of had an overground thing. The Justice League do it. And so I kind of do like that when you have the, you know, this group of people who remain in the shadows, but ultimately are helping people. That's a kind of version I like. And but it always gets that there's someone who's doing naughty as well. And they always get exposed one way or another, or they're corrupt, which is the problem. I like it when they're good.
Okay, well, personally, I've got to say, nobody does it better for me than Stephen King. I love a good biological disaster in fiction.
Yeah.
Caveat there. And obviously I love the Stand, but I also love the sort of the shadowy organization, the shop. The shop is what Stephen King calls it. The shop is kind of like the circus for Jean Le Carré. And obviously mm-hmm. when Jean Le Carré is saying the circus, he means the spy organization. He doesn't mean the literal circus.
Oh.
Stephen King does not mean an actual shop. He just means this government-funded black ops organization that deals with the scientific manipulation of certain data in order to create or weaponize specific yeah. things. So yeah, things like Firestarter, and then also there's the short story, Stephen King's version of a short story, which is about 12,000 words or more, Low Men in Yellow Coats, which was included in the anthology Hearts in Atlantis and was made into a film called Hearts in Atlantis. And the whole idea there is that you have this part of the shop that is rounding up psychics in order to use them during again the Cold War.
Yeah, see, the problem is that the whole time you were talking about that, all I could just imagine were clown spies. Just spies, but in complete in clown gear, like the big shoes and everything, the fake noses, the wigs.
That's really not ideal wear for a spy, is it?
Well, I don't know, actually. It depends noses, where you noses are.
Noses that honk and comically oversized shoes.
That bright red wigs. Very like small cars.
Yeah, that's not incognito, is it, really? I don't know. I guess people would never see it coming. The circus has come to town. Oh, we better look up all our sensitive data. And on that note, I think we should draw this to a close.
Yes, it is time to put this to bed. Before we do, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And I've got one now, which Jules is delighted about.
Yes, absolutely.
She's so excited by this.
I love it when I bully you into watching or reading something and you really love it.
Yeah. The problem is there aren't really that many examples of the other way around. Pushed you into doing something. Every now and again I push you into reading something and then you don't like it. I'm disappointed.
No, okay, look, I liked Harry Dresden, but I have issues. Anyway, please give us your recommendation.
My recommendation is DS9, Deep Space Nine, from the Star Trek universe. Now, obviously, Jules kind of pushed. I started out with Next Generation and kind of decided I'd watch Deep Space Nine afterwards because it was Jules's favourite. And I've got to admit, I really, really like it. I'm on season 4. I've kind of just been gobbling it all up. The characters are brilliant. Certainly, if you want conspiracies and all sorts of nasty little things, DS9 is great for that. And unlike things like Next Generation and even original Star Trek, there's a very different sort of setting for Deep Space Nine, not least because they don't have the same episodic structure. There are much longer arcs that last for longer periods of time, and you do get the quite a few to be continued episodes sometimes. Nice thing, of course, is that it's a finished series, so you can just sit and watch it on Netflix. You don't have to wait for weeks and weeks and weeks to get the next installment, which is wonderful. And I have really been enjoying it, and I do love the characters. So highly recommended. Apparently it's a Marmite series, so you'll either love it or hate it, but I hope you love it, and that's Deep Space Nine.
Yay. Obviously I recommend it.
Yeah. recommend it. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.